And now coming up, a big weekend ahead in presidential politics as the political season just got a little shorter, we'll explain. But first, today the current occupant of the White House held a surprise news conference as he heads out of town for vacation. President Bush discussed the economy, tax cuts, and he was asked whether he owed Americans more of an explanation about the lack of political progress in Iraq. He insisted that the Iraqi government is learning to function, but the president acknowledged that progress can be hard to measure.
For those of us who believe it's worth it, we'll see progress. For those who believe it's not worth it, there is no progress. And that's going to be the interesting debate.
For more on the press conference and the debate, the latest on the battle of the think tank experts over progress in Iraq, we turn to Bob Deans, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers. And Bob, Congress isn't in town. The president is leaving for vacation. So first of all, why do you think he called this press conference today?
He likes to do that before he's going to be gone for a couple of weeks. The president likes to hold a press conference when he's at the top of his game, if you will. He doesn't want to come back after being off for a couple of weeks and come under pressure to face those questions. And I think he wanted to frame up this looming debate about Iraq with this very significant moment coming in the middle of September when General Petraeus mm-hmm. comes back with Ambassador Ryan Crocker and delivers to Congress a progress report on Iraq. Mm-hmm. He wanted to frame that up, and with those words that you just recited, he did. He said those who don't believe that this is a cause we can win, don't believe it's worth it, they're going to say this is not sufficient progress. Those who still believe will cite it. I think he began to frame the debate up that way.
And of course, there are going to be those who are going to react to that by saying, wait a minute, just because I don't think it's working doesn't mean that I believe that, you know, it might be a good attempt, you know, that framing their frame of thought, I think, is going to provoke some reaction. But you say when the president is at the top of his game, he did thank the Congress for passing his wireless wiretapping request.
He thanked the Congress. He also took a very pointed jab at Congress, saying it's time for them to stop being such an investigative body and get back to their legislative job. They have 12 massive spending bills, which is sort of the road map for $2.9 trillion of budget spending for 08. Not one of those 12 bills has yet hit his desk, and so that's what he was alluding to there.
Well, the president, when he was speaking of Iraq, used almost as a mantra the phrase, is it worth it? Let's listen to a little of the president from today.
The fundamental question facing America is it worth it? Does it matter whether or not we stay long enough for a ally in this war against radicals and extremists to emerge? And my answer is it does matter.
And he went on to say it is worth it. And he noted that reporting from Iraq gives the impression that the country is totally dysfunctional. And we want to talk to you about a little of the context, perhaps. As you well know, there have been a flurry of editorials, opinion page pieces about just how it's faring in Iraq. Brookings Institution, Michael O'Hanlon, a self-proclaimed liberal, wrote recently in the New York Times about how he feels the U.S. might just win the war. Conservative editor of the Weekly Standard, William Kristol, leapt on that to conclude that Democrats now support the war. And today, defense analyst Anthony Cordesman weighed in, saying, wait a minute, I made the same trip to Baghdad that Michael O'Hanlon did, and I came out with a different perception. This is Cordesman speaking. He says, the U.S. does not have any good options in Iraq. So do you think that the president might have in part been reacting to this debate?
A little bit. I mean, he knows when he says, is it worth it? What's behind that is we've lost more than 3,600 young Americans killed, more than 27,000 wounded, many of them grievously so. The war has already cost the country, if you add the 08 budget figures, $567 billion. That number continues to rise. He knows all that's in the back of the minds of Americans. And so his answer is, this cost is worth it because the region matters. It's 60% of the world's known oil. The terror campaign matters. It matters to Americans. It matters to your children. It matters to your grandchildren. And the second question, he says, people are asking, of course, is can the United States succeed? And his answer was yes, and the way to do it is to maintain an assertive combat capability in Iraq, to buy time for political progress there, which he admitted had been slow, and to continue to stand up Iraqi forces. Surprisingly, or interestingly, Cordesman comes to a very similar conclusion.
This is Anthony Cordesman.
Right. Anthony Cordesman, who is a former Defense Department official who is now with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a very respected think tank here in Washington. He's a respected thinker on Iraq. And his conclusion was the United States, with no good options, must, going forward, keep troop levels high for the time being, buy time for political progress, and then carefully phase down, are his words, American troop levels there in Iraq as political and military progress is made and as Iraqis can take a increasingly larger role in their own security.
Bob Deans, what do you make over this, really in the last couple of weeks, what seemed like a really heightened debate with groups of people making trips to Baghdad and coming away with really different images? We had Thomas Ricks on as well, the Washington Post military correspondent, a terribly bleak scenario that he paints for the future of Iraq, and, you know, very different from, again, Michael O'Hanlon. So what do you make of this?
Well, I do think it's possible to go there and see the glasses half full or half empty, and I do think there's something to be said in what the president said. Those people who have made up their mind that the war is a disaster are going to continue to point to evidence that it is going poorly. Those people who go there and say, gee, we want this to work. And remember that O'Hanlon was accompanied by another analyst who had actually, Pollack, who had actually endorsed the war from the beginning. Michael Ricks has written a book called Fiasco, which is pretty definitive in terms of his view of the war. Mm-hmm. I think what Cordesman came back with was some data that said undoubtedly there have been military successes on the ground, but not sufficient to declare the surge a victory, and they have unfortunately not been accompanied by the kind of political progress that we need to see.
It was Kenneth Pollack, by the way, that was traveling with Michael O'Hanlon. Well, Bob Deans, a national correspondent for Cox Newspapers, thanks so much for speaking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
They've moved the goalposts in the 2008 run for president. South Carolina officials were in New Hampshire today to announce that South Carolina will now hold its primary earlier, moving it from February 2nd to January 19th, 2008, and setting in motion a domino effect that will push New Hampshire's primary and Iowa's caucus dates even earlier. New Hampshire has a state law requiring that its primary be held a week before any other primary in the nation, and Iowa holds its caucuses 8 days before any primary. So all that means that the first presidential balloting could happen before the new year. Today we're talking, we're checking in on the campaign trail with two veteran reporters. Holly Bailey is White House correspondent for Newsweek. She's in Iowa. Holly, welcome.
Thank you.
And the Republican Party straw poll is going to be taking place in Ames, Iowa this Saturday. We know you've got your eye on that. And Rick Klein joins us as well. He's senior political reporter for ABC News, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Rick, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you.
And Rick, first to this primary news. And we've been trying to do the math, and really if you push back a week from South Carolina, which New Hampshire will want to do, and then push back a week from that, which Iowa wants to do, you're running into Christmas. What do these dates mean?
Well, it was Florida that really started this chain reaction, because they took the date that was supposed to be South Carolina's date. That put South Carolina ahead to the 19th. We're assuming now New Hampshire will be January 12th, and it's very possible that that Iowa is going to want to move their date. In fact, probable. I don't think it's likely they'll be voting in 2007. I think in Iowa, officials realize that it almost becomes a joke. First of all, if you have a contest around Christmas and New Year's, no one's going to show up. Everyone's going to be on vacation. A lot of the national media will ignore it, and that's a way to become irrelevant. So the general thinking is that there'll be some flexibility with the setting of the date, but it may be the first week of January, which is earlier than it's ever been. I would bet against seeing anything happening in December, though.
At any rate, Holly, it's suddenly within view. I mean, I would think if I were a candidate in Iowa or anywhere, I'm thinking, wow, that's just a few months down the road. So let's talk about what's happening in Iowa this weekend. First of all, what are people talking about there? What are they asking the candidates, largely Republicans, because this is the Republican straw poll, but what do they seem to care about?
Well, surprisingly, at the town halls that I've been at this week, Iraq has not come up as much as I expected that it would. I went to several town halls for Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani, and went to a Mike Huckabee event, and mostly, you know, they're being asked about immigration is a huge topic. I've heard a lot of questions about education and health care, and at Romney's event yesterday and both of the Giuliani event that I went to earlier this week, Iraq was literally one question. And I'm not sure if that's because people already sort of feel that they know where the candidates stand or if they're just wanting to focus on other issues. It's really unclear.
And for, let's remind, you know, paint the picture for us. How does the Iowa straw poll work? Because it's part politics and then large part, you know, fair, the Iowa State Fair. So how do people vote? They buy a ticket?
They buy a ticket, and they go to Ames, and they listen to a lot of people speak all day.
The candidates put up big tents and, you know, lure people in.
They basically do everything they can to woo voters. I mean, it's sort of been a running joke a little bit, you know, among some of my colleagues at Newsweek, because we keep getting press releases, you know, from Sam Brownback, who's touting the barbecue he's bringing, and Mike Huckabee earlier this week announced that he was importing like a 150-pound watermelon, and how can people stay away from his tent? And Mitt Romney yesterday, actually, I went to a town hall, and he was giving people a free buffet, which was... It reminded me of Las Vegas a little bit. You know, there was steak and shrimp cocktail and 10 different cakes. And so people are really being wooed by food leading into the straw poll.
And that's, you know, we understand, too, that many of the campaigns pay for the tickets. I think it's a $35 ticket. They send out buses to bring people in. And what it all comes down to is maybe about 40,000 people do this, you know, take the ticket and get on the bus and come. So, and in this year in particular, Rick, let me ask you this. When top contenders John McCain and Rudy Giuliani say they're not even going to campaign because Mitt Romney spent so much money early on and seems to have it sewn up. So what's the importance of it?
Yeah, the question has been raised. It doesn't matter if you win a straw poll if you only beat straw men. I mean, this has never happened before. In fact, no one has skipped the straw poll and then gone on to win the Iowa caucuses. So John McCain actually skipped it in the 2000 cycle, and it came back to bite him, and he wasn't able to compete in Iowa at all. George W. Bush really became the conventional wisdom favorite because of his strong showing there. So it puts a lot of pressure, actually, though, on Romney, because now just winning isn't going to be good enough. And his people keep saying a win is a win. Win by 1 point, that's fine. Well, people are expecting him to run away with it. So the question is how much of a margin he needs to run up. Everyone assumes he's going to win it and win it going away. If he doesn't win it, it would be devastating to his campaign. If he wins it by just a few points, then the winner, quote-unquote, could be the second-place candidate. It's a lot like what happens in the early primary and caucus states where what matters is not so much who wins and who loses, but who exceeds expectations.
Well, and Holly Bailey, as you know, we were coming up on a break, and we're going to take that break. But as you well know, there have been some, controversies, but there's been some heated moments for Mitt Romney in the last couple of weeks having to do with an exchange he had on a radio talk show. We'll play that after the break. And also, he was asked why his five sons didn't serve in Iraq, and his answer was what?
Basically that, you know, this is a volunteer army, and one of the reasons that, you know, one of the reasons they're serving the country is campaigning for him to become the next president. And that has gotten a lot of headlines here in Iowa, people raising their eyebrows to see if that's a good answer or not.
Yeah, I said why his sons hadn't served in Iraq. The question was why they hadn't served in the military at all, and as you said, he answered, well, they're doing just as much service by campaigning for me. So we'll get more of Iowan's response to that and hear the exchange that he had with a radio interviewer. He didn't realize it was being taped. Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek, and Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, back in a minute. Now we're back with Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek, and Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. We're talking about the presidential campaign trail. The latest polls show Hillary Clinton ahead among Democrats, perhaps even pulling a little more ahead after her exchange this past week with Barack Obama about possible military strikes against Pakistan. And by the way, has that, you know, provoked any reaction in Pakistan? We'll talk about that. Mitt Romney expected to sweep the Republican Party straw poll in Ames, Iowa. Holly, you're there in Iowa. We were talking about the fact that last week Mitt Romney had an interview with a conservative radio talk show host in Marshalltown, Iowa. A television camera caught an off-air exchange with the host really pushing Romney on aspects of his Mormon faith, asking him things like, would the second coming of Christ happen in Jerusalem or Missouri? Which did Romney believe? It was really, quite something. And Romney was quite heated at the end of the exchange. Let's listen.
You're trying to tell me that I'm not a faithful Mormon, or that I'm not faithful to my church.
No, I'm trying to get you to reconcile what I think is a disparity
and have a great discussion about Mormonism and the Mormon Church and read the doctrines of the Church and where my view is. And you know what? I'm not running to talk about Mormonism.
Well, Holly, what was interesting to some of us here in the East is that some conservative talk stations here that support Romney are running this sound over and over and positioning it as almost, that a liberal interviewer was attacking him. But in fact, it was a conservative Christian. How is that exchange playing in Iowa? In fact, is it playing in Iowa? Are they playing it?
Well, people are definitely talking about it, and I hear two trains of thought about it. One, you know, that why hasn't he answered any questions about his faith? Why hasn't he, you know, come out to try to explain it more? On the other hand, people have said, okay, you know, this is a sign of high energy, and he defending himself. And people liked seeing that side, other than, you know, just sort of the, I guess people have described it as a wax figure at some of these events he's been at.
And we are also hearing in that some of the Mormon circles that some Mormons are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the questions that are not just that the questions are being raised, but some of the exchanges that are being had about their faith and the way he's positioning himself. But are you hearing that in Iowa?
Well, basically what I've been hearing is, you know, there's been a lot of curiosity about why he just hasn't come out to explain exactly what the Mormon faith is, what he believes. The risk is, you know, he said in response, well, I'm not running to be, you know, the Mormon president. I'm running for president, and that's why he's defended not talking about it. But at the same time, people have sort of, you know, they look at shows like Big Love and, you know, documentaries that have come out recently about the Mormon church that have been very critical of the religion and say, okay, well, this is, those things are defining him and what he believes. And there's been a lot of curiosity about why he just won't come out and explain more about it.
Well, let's take a look at the Democratic candidates. Rick Klein, some new polling out this week shows that Senator Hillary Clinton is pulling ahead, slightly beating or tiding Rudy Giuliani in some key states. She's also the clear front runner for her primary, the Democratic primary. A USA Today Gallup poll shows Clinton at 48% with Senator Barack Obama at 26%, John Edwards with 12%. Do you think there's some momentum that's being seen in the last couple weeks?
I do. It feels like Senator Clinton is solidifying her lead. There were some indications a few months ago that Senator Obama was gaining ground, that Senator Edwards was getting some traction. But we're seeing pretty consistently around a 20-point lead in the national polls. That hasn't been reflected in the state-level polls. But if you do see her pulling even or a little bit ahead, I've got to think that it's the kind of situation where if the election were held today, everyone knows about the huge lead she has in the national polls, that people would be saying, well, let's go with her. She's the consensus choice. That's exactly the argument the Clinton camp wants to make, that she is the inevitable candidate, that it's just a matter of time before everyone comes around to that same conclusion. There's a lot of time, even in the next 4 or 5 months, before we start the voting actually happens, and Iowa and New Hampshire voters, traditionally very unpredictable. But the Clinton folks have to be happy about how this fight with Barack Obama has played out.
Well, I was going to ask, how much have Barack Obama's comments on foreign policy helped or hurt him? He said he would back a unilateral strike in Pakistan to go after Osama bin Laden. Clinton said that the comment showed his naivete. You shouldn't reveal your cards. And now we're reading that exchange and his comments may have reached Pakistan and may have been a small part of President Musharraf's warning yesterday that he might call a state of emergency. He's since said he is not going to do that. But, can the Clinton camp position Barack Obama as affecting current foreign policy with his comments?
Well, I think at the debate the other night, at the AFL-CIO debate in Chicago, the fact that he was defending his comments against the range of Democrats, it wasn't just Senator Clinton, it was Senator Dodd, it was Senator Biden, it was Senator Richardson, Governor Richardson, all out there saying essentially, we don't think what you're saying is the right way to handle it. Senator Dodd in particular saying this is just not how a president talks. This is not how a would-be president talks. Those get at the central argument that a lot of his critics are making, which is that he's very inexperienced. He's only been in national politics for 2.5 years. He's never had any kind of an executive role. He's clearly learning, and a presidential campaign is a really tough environment for on-the-job training. learning. And every week it seems like there's something else that he's learning that should or shouldn't be said on the trail.
Meanwhile, just a quick note. You noted the AFL-CIO-sponsored debate in Chicago. Obama accused Hillary Clinton of accepting lobbyist money, and she said, she responded, again, attacking him for his foreign policy statements. But, Rick, you note that the Boston Globe examined Obama's record on receiving money from lobbyists, and what was the result?
Oh, I thought it was a really interesting take in today's paper, and basically looking at his record before he became a presidential candidate, and he was very active in soliciting and receiving lobbyist PAC donations. At the state level, certainly, he used a lot of their money in his early campaigns for the state Senate, but that even continued in his time in the Senate. And in fact, they did an interesting analysis that showed that as a portion of his total money that he raised as a U.S. senator, there was about 8% of the money from lobbyists and PACs, as opposed to 4% for Senator Clinton.
So that's obviously going to be come up again on the trail. We'll keep an eye on that. But in the meantime, in the few seconds we have, Holly Bailey, you're there in Iowa. We've got the Ames, Iowa Republican straw poll this weekend. It has become our custom. In the few seconds we have, what is the one thing you will refuse to eat at the state fair there?
I think it's going to be the hot beef sundae, which is looks and sounds pretty, it's going to be an act of presidential courage to eat that.
Ice cream and beans. Okay. Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Thanks, both of you, for helping us look ahead to the weekend.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And still ahead today, why do men hate going to the doctor's office? That's after the news, here and now. Now, a headline in a recent edition of Men's Health magazine caught our eye. Why men are babies, it read. Men? Babies? Bungee jumping, chest banging men? Yes. Not because, as Men's Health writes, they get sick at the sight of blood and make loud humming noises when lab results are discussed, true stories, but because between the ages 20 and 40, men don't go to the doctor. And no coincidence, those are the same years that men are twice as likely to die as women. Peter Moore is the editor of Men's Health magazine. He joins us now from his office in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
Your reporter, Dr. T.E. Holt, writes about his own frustrations with his fellow men. Why does he conclude that men don't go see the doctor?
There are some who consider it just the ultimate in pampering to consider their own aches and pains a large enough issue to make them go to the doctor. So those are the guys who wouldn't have their toenails painted and won't go to the doctor either. And then there are the other guys who really view going to the doctor as a way of surrender and control. As long as they don't go hear disturbing things from a stranger, they're not put in that position of having somebody poke and prod them, then they have the illusion that they're in control of their health when maybe the opposite is the case.
Well, many people agree with you. The American Academy of Family Physicians conducted an online survey. 36% of those surveyed say they only go when they're extremely sick. 92% said they're likely to wait a few days to see if they get better. Your author tells a story of a man who came in and he was the walking dead, had huge tumors on his skin, and he still hadn't gone. And Dr. Holt also asks if it's instilled in men or if it's biological. What is your sense of that?
My sense is that, isn't everything biological, including most of the psychological traumas that we put ourselves through? I mean, when you think about it, the last thing, if you are, allegedly a dominant male in the tribe or in the gaggle of whatever you belong to, the last thing you want to do is show that you're vulnerable to your enemies. The vulnerable party is the one that gets attacked first. And I think that, there are a lot of guys who view themselves as the leader of their family. The case of the farmer who you were talking about in our piece, he was the breadwinner for the family, and anything that would prohibit him from spending his 16 hours in the field laboring on the farm, he wasn't going to be any party to, and that's why he allowed his physical state to deteriorate the way he did.
Well, there is a theory that there is biology as well, though, that women have two X chromosomes, men one X and one Y. And so women can use that extra X to combat mutations, and it, in the long run, gives them a stronger constitution.
I completely believe in that. And, I think everyone would agree that one of the most difficult things that anyone ever accomplishes, at any time, is to give birth to a child. I think that implies enormous strength. And, maybe it's a way that, you know, women certainly are the stronger sex.
Well, Dr. Robert Tan, who's a geriatric specialist in Houston, he's on the advisory board of something called the Men's Health Network, a nonprofit in Washington. He says it's not that men could be the weaker sex. They are the weaker sex. There's proof in the fact that, for instance, even when men and women have the same disease, hip fractures, for instance, women are more likely to recover. Men are more likely to die afterward.
Well, and when you think about it, you know, we men dropping off 6 years earlier on average than women do, the strong survive. And congratulations, ladies, you do.
Well, but what about other factors? I mean, for instance, we know men tend to be more aggressive, take more risks, smoke at higher rates, drink more alcohol, less likely to wear seatbelts or use sunscreen. And so, you know, it would follow that they'd die perhaps of accidents or illness related to that.
Well, you know what? Men are expendable. That is the sad fact. Women provide an essential job in, you know, propagating of the species. They sustain it. Men labor to support the women, which is, you know, biologically, you know, an important role, but it's not the same as having the role of the actually reproducing the species.
Well, I have to hold you up there and point out, you just said this, not me, that
no,
men are dispensable. Are you saying sort of in a greater Darwinian way?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I also believe that it's something heroic that they do, that they are, you know, typically in the position of sacrificing themselves so that the women and children, you know, it's women and children first.
But your Dr. Holt writes, that's the biggest problem, that sense that it's seen as being heroic. I mean, back to the farmer who showed up at death's door and hadn't gone to the doctor. There's, you know, this sense that, isn't he great? You know, look at that. He doesn't even take time out to go to the doctor, but that's, you know, that's kind of...
I think, you know, close reading of the piece, Dr. Holt also admires the guy for not coming in on a certain level.
Yeah, but so, he says better a whimpering baby than a dead hero.
Yeah, I guess that's the argument that we'd have to have here. You know, clearly, you know, I'm the editor of a magazine called Men's Health, so that we think that we can have, you can be heroic and take care of yourself, which is, you know, one of the main points that we're making in this article, is that it needn't be inconsistent with, you know, your own image as a man to preserve your health and hang around so that you can be of service for longer.
Is it part of it, too, that women have been educated to know that they have to have routine checkups, pap smears, mammograms. And men, I mean, it started with fears of prostate cancer, but, you know, men really don't have that same indoctrination.
And when you think about it, you know, by the time your prostate starts acting up, you're already well along in life. You're in your 50s. Whereas, you know, girls, when they develop into women, you know, all of a sudden the gynecologist is a major part of their lives. And I also think that, you know, girls and women are, you know, much better at reaching out to those around them for counsel on what they need. Typical guy, I'm speaking of myself, I'm speaking of my two teenage sons, they tend to keep their own counsel on matters like that. I think that it's a fundamental communication difference between how men comport themselves and how women do it, and there's a lot of wisdom in the way that women do it.
Well, what do you think should happen now? I mentioned the Men's Health Network, this nonprofit in Washington. They're pushing for a federal office for men's health. We should say there's already one for women's health. But this has some women activists unhappy. They say they, for years, men got all the federal funding. They got all the advances in research. We know, I mean, to the extent that, you know, breast cancer was researched on men before it was researched in women. And they say, you know, we're just now making some strides. The last thing we need is to see, you know, attention taken away and put on men. But what do you think? Should there be a men's a federal office for men's health?
We certainly have advocated it for a long time for the simple reason that there are many health matters that are very specific to men, just as they are to women. You know, I have nothing but admiration for the success that women have had in advancing breast cancer research, but I'm also aware that, you know, the funding is about 2-to-1 breast cancer versus prostate cancer, even though the number of deaths per year for men and women are about equal. Mm. So, you know, the last thing I would want anybody to do is take research money away from research into breast cancer. If men aren't able to be activists for their own good, you know, to the degree that women are, then, you know, shame on them, and they need to get their act together and use their political clout to achieve great things just as women have.
Well, there may be one way to do that, and I'm going to leave you on this with this thought. Dr. Ken Goldberg has written a book called How Men Can Live as Long as Women, and he sort of suggests that if somebody can convince a man And he's saying this, not me. They should take care of themselves the way they take care of their trucks and their cars.
Automobile maintenance is a beautiful thing, and, you know, a guy's chassis deserves at least that much attention.
Peter Moore, editor of Men's Health magazine, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
Okay, and before we go today, actress Claire Danes, you're listening to Here and Now. The Federal Highway Administration is telling states to be careful not to put too much extra weight on bridges by adding construction crews. This comes after an investigation has revealed that the reason the I-35 bridge collapsed in Minneapolis may not have been age, but a design flaw. Well, here in Boston, a flaw in construction has proven to be the cause of last summer's partial collapse of a tunnel in the multi-billion-dollar Big Dig project. A woman was killed when panels fell from the ceiling of the tunnel. The National Transportation Safety Board investigation said it was because the wrong epoxy was used. It was a fast-drying epoxy, not a slow-drying one. Well, yesterday, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley announced the first criminal indictment in the case. A New York company called Powers Fasteners supplied the epoxy and now faces a charge of manslaughter for its alleged failure to warn contractors about the dangers of using that glue on the ceiling. Here now is Fred Tice, has been following the case. He joins us. And, Fred, this is a small company. Their president, Jeffrey Powers, said yesterday that he feels they were just being targeted because, quote, we don't have enough money to buy our way out. What is the evidence the state says they have against Powers?
Well, what's clearly coming out now is that both the state and the National Transportation Safety Board say they've reviewed the documents and have found that the only kind of epoxy that was delivered to the work site while the ceiling panel was being put up was the wrong kind of epoxy. So obviously, from their perspective, Powers knew that the wrong kind was being put up on the job site, and that's the thrust of the case.
And Jeffrey Powers has said that they did try to, you know, they told somebody.
They said they had one phone conversation with a state official who state officials say doesn't have anything to do with the Big Dig, and that official said he didn't like the fast-setting epoxy. But Attorney General Martha Coakley says she has no evidence that state officials knew that the wrong epoxy was being used.
And I guess even so, this is probably one of the questions that's going to be raised. If you knew that the wrong epoxy was in a huge project, if you feel a state official isn't listening, maybe they should have gone to the press or something.
Well, that's what the National Transportation Safety Board is telling Powers Fasteners, and of course that seems to be why they're now being indicted by the Attorney General.
Well, the NTSA investigation had harsh criticism for Bechtel Parsons. Brinckerhoff, that's the giant engineering consortium that managed the design and construction of the Big Dig, and also criticized the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority for its role. So do you see more indictments coming?
Martha Coakley, the Attorney General for Massachusetts, obviously won't say exactly what will happen. She says the grand jury is still sitting, the investigation continues, and we could expect more indictments, yes.
By the way, some would say in the indictment of the fastening company, I've read that the state penalty is a $1,000 fee, and we know that there was something a little over $1,200 worth of epoxy used. You know, with only a $1,000 fee to be gained, why is Martha Coakley doing this?
Well, here's some context. It's been reported by the Boston Globe that Coakley is negotiating with Bechtel, trying to get a $1 billion settlement out of them in exchange for dropping all charges against them. Now, it would make sense in that case to show that you can indict somebody in order to get the people with the deeper pockets to come to the table and reach an agreement with you.
Martha Coakley is working on behalf of the state. But the state is also being sued. So isn't she in an odd position here?
She is in an odd position. I guess you have to trust that she will prosecute breaking of the law wherever you see it. But, she has said that in her investigation she's not found that any state officials have done anything wrong. But you're right. She is also the representative of the state. So she's in an odd position.
By the way, she's being sued by the family of the woman who was killed.
That's right, Milena del Valle.
This seems particularly timely that Massachusetts is trying to wrestle with the legal questions around this collapse. As we see another collapse in Minneapolis and in other states are suddenly looking at their infrastructure and realizing that, well, some of it may not just be time. It may be actual flaw in construction.
Yes, and in this case, in the Big Dig, it looks like the design consultants also have come up for a lot of criticism from the National Transportation Safety Board people who should have looked at the designs and realized that something wrong might happen if you use the wrong kind of epoxy.
Here now is Fred Tice in Boston. Fred, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
When we come back, megastar Claire Danes plays a fallen star in her new film. That's after a break here and now. Here and now. In the new fantasy film Stardust, Tristan, the hero, makes a rash promise.
Oh, Tristan, a shooting star! Ah, oh, beautiful!
Victoria, for your hand in marriage, I'd cross the wall and I'd bring you back that fallen star.
What Tristan doesn't know but will soon find out is that the star he's vowed to bring back is now in human form. She's called Yvain, and he's not the only one seeking her, for the possession of that star's heart brings immortality. Stardust is based on the novel by best-selling author Neil Gaiman. It features an all-star cast, including Robert De Niro as a pirate captain with a softer side, Michelle Pfeiffer as a witch bent on capturing the star, British comedian Ricky Gervais plays a lowlife peddler, Claire Danes is Yvain, the star that falls to Earth. Claire Danes, from the cult favorite TV series My So-Called Life to films like Romeo and Juliet, she's had a stellar career. She also previously voiced a character in one of Gaiman's films and wrote a foreword to one of his graphic novels. Well, here now's Renee Graham recently caught up with Claire and asked her, how does one play a fallen star?
Well, what's so great about it is that it's written, you know, in such a straight way. She's just kind of cranky, really. It was a tough fall. She has a slightly injured leg. I mean, it was a little challenging playing that, you know, convincingly, but also not being so grating as to irritate and offend audiences, you know.
You've worked with Neil Gaiman before.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the main appeal for you with doing this project?
Well, I was struck by the charm of the script. It was really wonderfully realized and just so odd, so absurd. But no, it wasn't necessarily out of my loyalty to Neil, as much as I love him. If I didn't love his story, I wouldn't have gotten involved. But he's a really spectacular writer.
Neil Gaiman has such devoted fans. Do you feel a certain responsibility in portraying Yvain?
Well, I always feel a responsibility when I play any character. I mean, I just am desperate to not completely ruin it. But yeah, of course there's an added pressure when I'm aware of how many people appreciate this character and have a particular idea of who she is in their minds.
By what?
Immortality. I'd say it wasn't my heart. Not me. Just a star you didn't know.
Even if I could. Everlasting light. I imagine it would be kind of lonely.
Talk a little about the cast. This is an incredibly varied cast and a lot of very well-known people in smaller roles, from Ricky Gervais to Michelle Pfeiffer, who you've worked with before, to Robert De Niro.
It was astonishingly great. Yeah, it was almost spooky. I was completely overwhelmed with excitement when I found myself in a scene with Ricky Gervais and Robert De Niro. I was giddy. I just so loved seeing Bob, that it's so cool that I can actually say that legitimately. Yeah, it was great to see him fan himself and throw a boa over his shoulder. You know, yeah, playing a poof, as they say in England.
Yvain, I know what you are. Don't have no fear. No one on this vessel will harm you, but there are plenty who would.
Your emotions give you away, Yvain. You must learn to control them. You've been glowing more brightly every day, and I think you know why.
Of course I know why I'm glowing. I'm a star.
you've worked with Michelle Pfeiffer before. It was to Julian on her 37th birthday, and you've gotten to work with her again, obviously, with Stardust. Talk about the two experiences, what you learned from her, looking at her career and doing Stardust.
Well, she's obviously unnervingly beautiful. I mean, it is almost alien, but she's also incredibly bright and gifted, and I think her beauty can confuse people or overwhelm her talent even, but she's terrific. I can't say that I've learned any one thing from her exactly, but I admire her.
Due west, you say, and you're certain he had a girl with him?
Yeah.
You're sure? Absolutely sure? Sure you're not lying?
I'd cross my heart if I had one.
Stardust is your second film being released this summer. The first was Evening, a film which seemed to fail to connect with audiences and critics. Why do you think that film ended up having that fate?
I don't know. It's mysterious to me because I think it's actually a really wonderful movie. I don't think it has failed to connect with audiences. But, yeah, a lot of critics were critical. I think they accused it of being sentimental, and I think they were mistaken, actually. I think the opposite is true.
So you like the film, you like the way the film turned out, you feel that somehow critics just didn't get it for whatever reason.
Yeah. I can never anticipate their reactions to things. I mean, movies that I'm not as proud of, they've embraced fully. I can't follow the logic.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about My So-Called Life. To what do you credit the enduring popularity of that show?
I would say the writing. I think the writing is just exquisite. It's very, very strong. It's proven to be over time. And the cast was terrific as well. I mean, I think it was just a confluence of wonderful elements. And it was really fresh at the time. That kind of storytelling was not so common on TV.
When's the last time you saw an episode?
They're releasing a DVD of it. So I actually did some commentary with Winnie Holtzman, who wrote it. That was fun. It was strange to revisit it. I was very squeamish, but well, because anybody is when they see themselves at 14, I think. yeah, but I really like it a lot still.
Huge events take place on this earth every day. Earthquakes, hurricanes, even glaciers move. So why couldn't you just look at me?
I understand you're going to be doing Pygmalion on Broadway, which will be your Broadway debut. Why that project and why Broadway now?
Well, I've been curious about what it is to perform on stage for a while. I mean, I started dancing again about 3 years ago. I initially discovered acting through dance when I was a kid. And so that was very fulfilling. And maybe this is a progression of that. But it was offered to me, and it's a fantastic piece of writing, fantastic character.
It's got to mean a lot to you as a native New Yorker to know that you're going to be making your Broadway debut.
Yeah. It's scary! Right now, it's really intimidating because, you know, it's very much looming, it's imminent, but it's maybe as exciting as it is terrifying. I don't know what is more motivating, the excitement or the terror.
When she goes outdoors, the butterflies all fall out from door to door. Whenever she spoke, the hearts of the downtrodden
That was actress Claire Danes speaking with Here Now's Renee Graham. Her film Stardust opens in theaters tomorrow, and she also has sort of a genre of music dedicated to her. This is Claire Danes, If You Ever Get a Nose Job, I Swear to Jesus I'll Hang Myself, by the Lesser Birds of Paradise. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
She hovers like a rock. You might slip into a tube song before smacking a guy upside his head. She
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.